dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people who I believe have contributed more over a longer period of time without generally anywhere near the recognition they deserve than a friend and colleague of mine of many years. I'm speaking of his service to our country, both in government and that he has rendered since he left office as the senior director for international economic affairs in Ronald Reagan's National Security Council under a number of, well, different organizational affiliations, notably RWR Advisory Group, which he founded and is the president of. But he was also the chairman and also the ranking member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission for a number of years. And he has been a very active contributor to the public policy debate through his chairmanship of another organization he founded, the Prague Security Studies Institute. He's an international banker by training, but a great public servant and an extraordinary comrade in arms in the fight for the free world. His name is Roger Robinson. Roger, it's so good to have you back with us. Welcome, and thank you for taking a few minutes to talk a bit about a very important presentation you made to the Securities and Exchange Commission last week. I'm anxious to talk about it. Welcome. So let's set the stage for this conversation a little bit, Roger. You have been, since you worked for President Reagan, very thoughtful about and quite impactful concerning the ability of enemies of this country, notably back in that period, the Soviet Union, and more recently, the Chinese Communist Party, and the ability that these totalitarian, hostile powers have had to raise funds in the West in general or specifically here in the United States. Give us just a little bit of that backstory, because when we talk about what you told the SEC last week, it's really important for people to understand the history here.
Well, Frank, although that SEC gathering, a roundtable on emerging markets, was focused on China, you're quite right that this is not a new phenomenon. If we flip back in time to the Soviet Union, it was the case that, for example, their total hard currency income at, say, 1982 was just about $32 billion a year. They were spending $16 billion more than they made each year. And 100% of that amount was, in the end, financed by Western governments and banks. Now, that happened to coincide with roughly the hard currency cost of the entire external Soviet empire. And so you can see that the West was unwittingly playing an inordinately important role in keeping the Soviet empire a going concern. Now, if we project forward to our Chinese friends...
Well, before you do that, it does need to be said that you helped President Reagan cut off that cash flow, and the rest, as they say, is history. A story for another day. It's captured brilliantly, by the way, I think, in Peter Schweitzer's first book, if I'm not mistaken, Victory. But it needs to be both acknowledged and saluted, Roger Robinson, because I think it was an extraordinarily important contribution to, well, the war for the free world back in that period, that you were able to recognize that tremendous vulnerability of the Soviet Union and help President Reagan, well, essentially wage economic war against that evil empire until it was able to be toppled as a result. So hats off to you for that, sir. Move on, if you would, to the China story, because that's, of course, where we need to focus our energies at the moment.
Well, the common denominator there, Frank, as you pointed out, is to follow the money and to understand that these totalitarian authoritarian police states do have a problem, that neither the Soviets or the Chinese have convertible currencies. The capital markets of the United States are the basically the size of the rest of the world's combined. We have over 60% of the world's liquidity, not to mention the world's reserve currency. We utterly dominate the financial domain on this planet. It was the case then, it's the case now. Moving to China, they've been able to tap in to the U.S. capital markets, a different venue than was available to the Soviet Union in the span of time here, and issue through equity offerings, stock that is, and bond offerings, as much as $3 trillion or more in the past several years, out of unwitting American investors. And I'm talking about scores of millions of them. And this has been something that we've not looked at in the 25 years that it's been going on. There's been no screening of who these Chinese companies are, what they do for a living, what their subsidiaries are all about. Many have been sanctioned by the United States. They're national security abusers. They're human rights offenders, the type of companies that are equipping concentration camps in Xinjiang and providing facial recognition technology to pick up Tibetans at train stations. In other words, these are companies that are corporate bad actors by any definition. And they are raising funds with no screening, with no diligence, with no scrutiny. And this has gone on for such a long time that there are now hundreds, if not over 1,000 Chinese companies embedded in the portfolios, unwittingly again, of the American investor community, about 170 million strong. And that's where we sit. So it's a very unsatisfactory state of affairs. The SEC should have been policing this. They are the chief regulatory body. They have fallen down on the job. And I laid it out to them in very clear terms, my view of this, last Thursday at this roundtable session.
This is what I want to get into, Roger, when we come back from a short break. But let me just summarize what you've said, which is so staggeringly alarming, really. And that is that we have been underwriting and thereby enabling, through the investments of mostly unwitting investors in this country's capital markets, stock and bond markets, the mortal threat that we currently face from this era's, as Ronald Reagan used to say, existential threat to freedom. And until you really came up on the net about this, and we've been very proud to work with you, those of us on the Committee on the Present Danger of China, in elevating this issue. But really, this was totally unrecognized as a preeminent national security and human rights, as well as investor protection problem. And so I salute you for that. We're going to talk more about the implications of it and what you said to the chairman and the members of the Securities and Exchange Commission last Thursday about their failure, their, well, I think, malfeasance in this regard. We'll do with that and much more with Roger Robinson, Ronald Reagan's top hand, I think it's correct to call him, and economic matters at the National Security Council back in the day, and these days the president of RWR Advisory Group. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are continuing a conversation with Roger Robinson, one of the most unsung and most impactful people I've had the privilege of working with over 40 years in Washington, D.C., on national security and economic and financial security matters in particular. Roger is the president and founder of an extraordinarily important research organization entitled RWR Advisory Group. He is also the chairman and co-founder of a wonderful organization with both a presence in the Czech city of Prague and here in Washington, D.C., called the Prague Security Studies Institute. So, Roger, we've set the stage for the problem that you addressed with this so-called staff meeting on emerging markets that the Securities and Exchange Commission convened last week. It turns out that the chairman and all of the members of the commission were in attendance when you and two others spoke. Tell us what the subject matter was and what were really the key points that you communicated in the course of those remarks to the commission as well as its staff and a lot of others, as it turns out, who were listening in.
Well, it was a roundtable on emerging markets, but because China so dominates that particular space, we were fortunate to have the focus of my panel from 10 to 10:50 a.m. that led off this rather elaborate roundtable that was apparently listened into by hundreds, if not more than hundreds, of Wall Street executives. So it was just an extraordinary opportunity, frankly, to speak very candidly about where we stand. And you had mentioned, for example, in the last segment, investor protection. Let's put aside just for a moment the horrific nature of the national security and human rights abuses and threats that the American people, through their investments, are unwittingly underwriting or helping underwrite. And just look at the job of the SEC and the public company accounting oversight board, the PCAOB, which is a subset of the SEC. These folks are first and foremost supposed to be protecting the average American investor from material risks to the share value and corporate reputation of the companies in which they're invested. And this has fallen down in a scandalous way. In May of 2013, the administration, the Obama team at the time, were willing to waive China's requirement to adhere to federal securities laws, Sarbanes-Oxley, Dodd-Frank. They were waived off of having to disclose their financials and allowed to keep them in a black box under the guise of state secrets.
Wait a minute. Let me just stop you there, Roger. How could that possibly be? I mean, the laws of the land require accountability, specifically meeting a pretty high standard because of problems for investors from a failure to insist on such accounting standards in the past. You're telling me that the Chinese Communist Party's front companies were somehow able to be just given a waiver on having to meet those standards?
Not just for the 7 years since 2013. Let's try 20 years. They've never been in compliance with federal securities laws. They have consistently received preferential treatment over their American corporate counterparts, which have to pay, you know, significant funds to have these audits to participate in our capital markets. All of that is skewed in favor of China today. As remarkable as that sounds, and it's a golden invitation for fraud, like the Luckin Coffee extravaganza that cost shareholders overstated earnings by $310 million, just made it up in the case of Gangmai Pharmaceuticals, tried more than $4 billion, again, manufactured. So, in other words, this has to do with actual losses by American investors, institutional and retail, meaning the average American investor. So this is where we sit. And this problem has been known about for a long time. The Chinese never worked some kind of equivalent enforcement mechanism of the type that we would insist on. There's nothing happened at all, except the Chinese have become more recalcitrant, if anything, about obeying our securities laws. They have forbid their companies to do so. That's in law, by the way. So we have that dimension. Then we have, of course, the financing of ballistic missile submarines, nuclear aircraft carriers, as I said, the facial recognition technologies and the like for the surveillance state and the social credit system that is so offensive, properly so, to the human rights community worldwide, not just in the United States. And all of this has been ignored systematically. And all of this was laid out among a number of other points.
We're going to post at the Committee on the Present Danger China's website, Roger, the transcription of this panel that you participated in. And that will all be available at presentdangerchina.org, folks. And I really commend to you. Several of the participants made interesting points, but Roger's were quite extraordinary in terms of both the clarity with which, Roger, you characterized the problem and the way you really called out the SEC, as well as these exchange-traded fund managers and index mavens and the like. I did want to ask you, Roger, about one piece of this that I particularly feel is extraordinarily outrageous, and that is the fact that the company that is arguably the most responsible in China for this social credit system that you talked about, which is, of course, oppressing Uyghurs and Tibetans and Christians and Buddhists and others, but it's also being used to oppress the people of China writ large, managing, you know, and micromanaging and certainly monitoring and in some cases punishing their behavior. What I'm struck by is that this company, Hikvision, as it's called, is now one of those identified by the Defense Department of the United States as a, quote, communist Chinese military company, unquote, that is doing business in the United States. And your research at RWR Advisory Group, and you might just give us your website there, Roger, so people can get access to this, indicates that this is one of 13 of 20 companies that the Pentagon has so identified, PLA, People's Liberation Army companies, that are actually in our capital markets as well as, you know, doing heavens knows what, stealing technology and doing mergers and acquisitions and joint ventures and perhaps subversion, that sort of thing. But in our capital markets as well, Raj, what is up with that? People's Liberation Army companies, including some doing what you talked about a moment ago, building ballistic missile submarines, building, you know, nuclear aircraft carriers, building this surveillance state apparatus. What is that about and what can we do about it?
Well, it would be one thing, Frank, if it was a modest footprint in our capital markets that these 13 of the 20 PLA-affiliated companies identified by the Pentagon were involved in. But that's not the case. Their footprint is a heavy one. They are in virtually every emerging market index of the United States and the associated exchange-traded funds that are built around those indexes as the investable vehicle for the American people. It was just extraordinary. We did visuals on this. It was the same kind of disturbing revelation to see that of the five states that we just chose, you know, like the Floridas and the New Yorks and California and others, they too had those same 13 PLA-related companies littering their portfolios. So again, if you take Hikvision, Honshu Hikvision Digital Technologies, I think it might be the name, the full name. But the point being, let's just look at that. Its parent company is on the blacklist of the Commerce Department for national security reasons, the so-called entity list. Hikvision itself has now been placed on the entity list of the Commerce Department, prohibiting sales of components and so forth to those companies absent licenses that are designed not to be granted by the Commerce Department. And yet, despite the fact that their parent company themselves, and then add to that the PLA-affiliated identification that has been branded on them by the Pentagon, and not one U.S. index that I know of has divested that stock to date. It is still a staple in the indexes and the ETFs of this country. Now, these are trillions of dollars of funds under management in these pools, these index funds that have become the new dominant event on Wall Street. This is merely a symptom of a disease, and it has spread to the point where something has to be done. The president is alarmed by this, fortunately, as is the director of the National Economic Council, the National Security Advisor to the president is alarmed by what he's seen, and the president has intervened himself to stop the federal thrift savings plan funds of federal employees from being invested in these same companies that are in the MSCI, All Country World ex-U.S. Index.
Roger Robinson, thank you so much for this. Obviously, we need a reprise of the Thrift Savings Plan decision. The president needs to know about these People's Liberation Army companies that are operating in our country, and he needs to take action, as he did in that earlier instance, to shut them down in our capital markets and in our country. I hope he will, and if he does, I know it will be in no small measure, Roger, thanks to the great work that you've been doing at RWR Advisory Group, rwradvisory.com. Check it out, folks. Roger, thank you so much for this important update. Congratulations on your work with the SEC last week. I hope they're heeding it. And I hope you'll come back to us with further updates very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang and talk a bit more about why this effort to cut off the communist Chinese cash flow is so vitally needed. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back for what is one of the high points of this week's programming. It is our visit with Gordon Chang, our duty expert on China and Asia more generally. He is that of most of the free world, for that matter. You see him frequently in various spots like Fox News and contributing mightily through his writings in places like The Daily Beast and The National Interest, among other places. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You can follow Gordon Chang, of course, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. He is the author as well of a brand new broadside at Encounter Books entitled The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He's always welcome, and most especially at a moment when there is so much to talk about as to what's going on with China. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir. Gordon, I'd like to talk to you about a natural phenomenon that seems to be creating devastation on an enormous scale in China, and that may yet get a lot worse, depending on what happens with the so-called Three Gorges Dam. Tell us about this. Our friend J.R. Nyquist has attributed it to phenomenon called the Grand Solar Minimum, which seems to be in the works. It's creating enormous amounts of rainfall in southern China in particular. What's the effect of that and its possible implications?
The flooding in southern China is almost unprecedented, and state media right now is working very hard overtime to say it's not going to be as bad as previous flooding incidents, but clearly it is. And this brings into the question the Three Gorges Dam. The main justification for building the dam was controlling the flooding on the Yangtze, which is a centuries-old problem. But the dam does not appear to be helping in that regard. Matter of fact, maybe aggravating the situation. They've got one issue which environmentalists knew from the very start, and that was the dam was going to end up aggravating the silting. And there is no solution for it, and that silting behind the dam has apparently made the flooding worse. These rains haven't stopped. They're actually moving into northern China as we speak. This is something that the Communist Party has really devoted a lot of effort to because it knows that it is responsible for much of the devastation.
Gordon, knowing the Chinese Communist Party and the way it does business, this won't come as a surprise to you, but there are growing reports that shoddy engineering and construction of the Three Gorges Dam may be creating conditions in which it could fail catastrophically, in which case the flooding we've seen to date and the damage that it's caused, and I believe I'm told something like half of China's provinces may pale by comparison. I do hope that, God forbid, that unfolds. We will not make the mistake of coming to the rescue of the Chinese Communist Party as opposed to the people of China. But that's for another day's conversation. Let me turn to another issue that, of course, is brought to the forefront by, once again, the leadership of, I think, our great Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. He took on the Chinese with respect to their claims to the South China Sea a day or so ago, Gordon Chang. Talk to us about why that's so important and what might be the upshot of it.
The Secretary's statement yesterday is critical. Previously, the United States was saying that it would not take a position on sea claims. The statement refers to is not who has sovereignty over the various features in the South China Sea, islands and reefs and such, but really China's claims to the waters around them. And those claims the U.S. maintains, and it certainly is the case, those claims are in violation of international law, not just the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea, to which China is a party, but also just customary international law. The reason why this is important is because, for instance, so much of the world's commerce passes through the South China Sea. But there's a more fundamental issue, and that is that if the world allows China to close off the South China Sea, which is part of the global commons, then other countries will close off parts of their global commons, which abut their territory. And so the world has prospered since the end of the Second World War because of an open international waters and airspace. So we can't allow countries like China to end up changing the fundamental nature of the international system by closing off the global commons.
I'm somewhat averse to this whole idea of a global commons, as it's UN speak for this idea that everybody's, you know, equal and got a share of it. But I think there's no doubt about it. What the Chinese are doing to assert their sovereignty over it is a serious threat to the globe's interests as well as our own vital interests, Gordon Chang. And I commend Mike Pompeo for holding, you know, the Chinese Communist Party to account. And I hope, as we're watching our two aircraft carriers operating out in those waters, the message is clear and credible to the Chinese that we're there to stay and we will not be dictated to as to what use we make of those waters or should anybody else. This raises a question, though, Gordon. As you know, the United States Navy has just, it seems, lost one of its really vital capital ships in San Diego, the Bonhomme Richard. What do you think the view of the Chinese is of this loss as it relates to what I fear is one of their sort of hardy perennial estimations of our power, namely that it's fleeting? They're there. They're especially on these islands in the South China Sea that back up their claims to sovereignty. Are they discounting us, do you think? And what might that lead to in terms of perhaps miscalculation and even conflict?
Well, I think through 2018, certainly China thought the United States was in terminal decline. 2019 probably was a different story as China suffered setback after setback. You know, with regard to the Bonhomme Richard, apart from reporting, I don't think that there has been any substantial propaganda output on it. But this is important because there have always been concerns that the management of the U.S. Navy is severely deficient. And this comes after, of course, the two collisions involving Arleigh Burks, both of which are fatal. This is important because this is not a China issue. This is a U.S. Navy issue. We don't have a big fleet to start out with. We can't afford to lose ships, and we are losing ships. Not because of the Chinese, but because of the failure of Navy to manage itself, to train, to operate. And so, therefore, that is going to be a major issue going forward.
Let me ask you, Gordon, if I can, about this much ballyhooed retaliatory sanctioning by the Chinese Communist Party of Senators Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Congressman Chris Smith, and Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, in retaliation for the sanctioning that we did of some of those responsible for oppressing Uyghurs and others in China. It does seem as though it's rather odd to me that people who are prominent defenders of freedom are the people the Chinese are holding forth against, and we are trying to penalize those who are really brutally denying people their liberties. Besides that contrast, what's going on here, do you think?
Well, both the State Department and the Treasury Department sanctioned four individuals. The Treasury Department imposed global Minsky sanctions, freezing assets and the rest. State Department imposed travel restrictions. This was important because for the first time ever, the U.S. has sanctioned a member of the Politburo, Chen Kuan-guo, the party secretary of what China calls the Xinjiang Autonomous Uyghur Region. And that's good. That's, I thought, a very important step. But also we got to remember that Chen is not the author of the crimes against humanity in Xinjiang, with the Uyghurs and the others call East Turkestan. These policies go all the way to the top, to the Politburo Standing Committee, especially Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler. And we should be sanctioning the seven people on the Standing Committee, plus including, of course, Xi Jinping. But in a sense, we're making progress. And that's important. Also, the one thing that China does, and this is, I think, shows how counterproductive China's actions are. They've given new prominence to Ambassador Brownback and America's efforts on religious freedom by sanctioning him. And so the sanction on Brownback was particularly good from our perspective because it brings into play and gives more prominence to something that the U.S. has not been getting enough attention about.
So much more to say on that subject, but it'll have to wait for another day, because I did want to introduce one other thing, Gordon. There is a report out of Australia about the comprehensive efforts of the Chinese Communist Party's various intelligence agencies to subvert, as well as conduct espionage and dominate the economy and otherwise engage in influence operations in Australia, one of our key allies in the Pacific. Was there anything newsworthy there as far as you were concerned, or is it simply enough that one of our allies is now pretty clear-eyed about the magnitude of this threat, and shouldn't we be as well?
Yeah, Australia, along with Canada, of our close allies, have been thoroughly penetrated by China, and we see in both countries movements in the right direction, but especially in Australia under Prime Minister Scott Morrison, the Liberal, who's been in power since 2018. Since that time, Australia has taken a number of very important steps to counter Chinese influence across the board. So remember that Australia was the country among the world's countries that led the charge for an independent investigation into China's handling of the coronavirus. We know that China's intelligence operatives operate freely in Australia. Just in the last 48 hours, a woman was in Melbourne, I believe, said that she was being harassed openly by Chinese operatives on Australian soil. So this is a problem that has become unavoidable for the political establishment in Australia. They've got to deal with it, and Morrison is the guy to do it.
Gordon Chang, thank you so much for your time today, as well as the tremendous service you are providing our country in terms of your clear-eyed analysis of what the Chinese are doing and your articulate exposition of its importance for all of us. Keep it up, my friend. I know you will. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Michel Garfinkel. We will celebrate Bastille Day by noting the really dire circumstances in which France finds itself now at the hands of the Islamists, the enemy within. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is, well, appropriate to recognize the national holiday of the French Republic, that is Bastille Day, with a visit with our friend in Paris, Michel Garfinkel, one of the great minds in France, a patriot, a friend of Western civilization, a freedom fighter, I think, for the free world in this war for its future that I believe we find ourselves once again in the midst of. Michel is the editor-at-large for Valeurs Actuelles. He is also the founder and president of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute. He's a good friend and a very valued colleague. And thank you, Michel, for taking a few minutes out of your national holiday celebrations to visit with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us. Michel, the reason that we were particularly keen to talk, the holiday being just an opportunity to catch up with you, I think, is that there was a very alarming report. I'm not saying it was surprising to those of us who've been following, with your help often, what's going on in France, but nonetheless, alarming report out of the French Senate about a week ago concerning the state of the, well, I think of it as Sharia supremacist threat. I believe it's been described as the Islamists' threat to the French Republic. Tell us sort of the highlights of this report. Who did it and what are its most important findings?
This report has been, in fact, issued by the French Senate. It was conducted by two members of the Senate, two women senators. One is Nathalie Delattre, who is a senator for the Gironde, which means from Bordeaux. And the other one is a conservative senator, Jacqueline Eustache-Brignaud. She is a senator for Val d'Oise, which means the Greater Paris. So one of them, Delattre, is more left of center, while Eustache-Brignaud is somewhat conservative. This report was, in fact, conducted on behalf of the French Senate. There was a World Commission working on a lot of data. There were a lot of hearings. And the conclusion is alarming. It says that, first of all, religion and Islamism as different from the Muslim religion, Islamism is that trend within Islam that says that Islam has to lead to a political system. There is no Islam without a political construct that will foster it. So both the religion, the Muslim religion is growing very quickly in France, and within French Islam, Islamism, political Islam, is growing very quickly as well. And political Islam, Islamism, simply endeavors to turn France into a Muslim state, to change the constitution of France into an Islamic constitution. And what the report says is that Muslim activists have realized that they cannot do it for the time being. So they are doing it very patiently. The first stage for them is to create within French society a separate, autonomous Muslim community, and then to work in such a way that this state within the state will be gradually, over the years, able to take over the French state and the French society in total.
So this is, Michel Gerfinkel, in no small measure, a recognition of something that you have been warning about, as have we, for some time, namely that this is not simply a matter of people practicing their faith. This is an organized, determined effort to take over the country of France. Initially, there are areas, no-go zones, they've been called. I believe there are now 150 that are recognized by this report. The number in the past has been higher than that, I believe. But there's also, it seems, a pretty clear recognition that the Muslim Brotherhood is one of the driving forces behind this effort to stealthily undermine and ultimately supplant the government of France. Is that right?
Yes, correct. There is the Muslim Brotherhood, but one should probably stress that there are more Muslim Brotherhoods besides the Muslim Brethren. There is not one single group, but several groups that may be at time competing in order to achieve the same goal. I would like to make an additional remark. It is that we have had at least two presidents of France. I'm talking about the former president, a socialist, François Hollande, and the present president, Emmanuel Macron, who is a centrist. And both of them have warned that France is now standing close to a situation of partition. This is what Hollande said a few years ago, or a situation of separatism. And this is what Macron is saying now. And both of them say that this is now the major problem that France as a nation is facing.
There are those who feel that it's too late for France, that things have gotten to such a pass that that kind of trajectory is now inevitable. The French Senate report, as I understand it, Michel Gerfinkel, identifies 44 different steps that might yet be taken by the government of France. Could you give us a sense of the most important of them and whether you think, in fact, if they were followed, they would make a difference and whether they are likely to be followed?
In fact, what is really interesting about this report is that it has very carefully detected a lot of seals where the Islamists are stealthily moving and with great efficiency. For instance, let us talk about sports clubs. There is nothing more innocent than sport. What the report established is that more and more sports clubs all over the country are organized along religious and activist religious lines. And there are many other such activities which, on the face of it, look totally innocuous and totally legal, but which in fact help the Islamists to develop a kind of counter society within French society. And what is the most interesting about the report is that it is listing a lot of such fields where the French government now must act and must impose regulations that will make it difficult for the Islamists to hijack the otherwise innocent ways of bringing people together.
This is vitally important, of course, Michel. Do you anticipate, given the lateness of the hour, that these kinds of recommendations will now be adopted by the French government? And if so, it will suffice.
There has been some effort from the French government, and it started even before the Macron administration. There are some efforts to do things about all that. I must say that there is one section of the Muslim community in France which doesn't follow the guidelines of the Islamists and which is really willing to integrate the democratic fabrics of French society. And the government in France is very much working with these patriotic Muslims in order to counter the Islamists.
Thank you so much for your time today, Michel Gerfinkel, as well as the great work that you have been doing and are now doing at Valeurs Actuelles and the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute. We'll look forward to visiting with you further. Enjoy the rest of your Bastille Day holiday. I hope the rest of you will enjoy the Bastille Day too here in the United States, perhaps, as well as join us again tomorrow for more of Secure Freedom Radio. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.